I talk to people about criticism of, you know, movies or books or whatever, I'm always like, the main thing I want to see or engage with is like, I really want the element of like surprise at some point. And I don't think the surprise has to be shocking or like bombastic, but I do think I need to be like caught off guard of what I've seen in stories before.
You're listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Fran Hoffner.
You're Chad today, Fran.
Yeah, I'm surprised, Chad.
Sorry, I know I'm used to introducing you, but...
No, I'm just here.
It's good when you're just co-hosting.
Yeah.
You're co-hosting and guesting all in one.
Yeah, easy. Easy for me. No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on.
This is a very special episode of the Bright Wall Darkroom podcast, where Fran Hoffner is joining us to talk about the 61st edition of the New York Film Festival.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. I mean, I would say to our listeners, but obviously this is going to come out way, way, way after Halloween because this is our November episode. But I know that you recently wrote about being in your brave era, though you've been telling me that you're in your brave era for like over a year.
It's been like 4 years of bravery, but that could end at any second.
I think the metamorphosis is complete.
No, definitely not.
Do you have any other scary movies like lined up for, Halloween?
I don't know about lined up, but I just watched Exorcist 3 last night, which I loved.
Did you? And you did the other two as well?
No, I just did the first one. We skipped two.
Okay, amazing.
I hear two is not that good, but then the two defenders will swoop in and be like, well, you sort of need it.
I don't even know if I've ever seen two.
Have you seen three?
I don't think I have. Is it streamable?
It was streamable on Shudder, which we have.
Oh, amazing.
I thought it was great, yeah. Not the least of which because, you know, horror gets thrust to the side as like not maybe like a Hollywood genre necessarily. You know, it's sort of trashy. And it's Exorcist 3 is, you know, despite not having the Friedkin name behind it, I think it's a very Hollywood movie. It's very showbiz. In a way that really appealed to me, even though it was very scary also. But it's definitely a movie that like wants actors to have monologues. And I don't know. I think being like, what if we put George C. Scott in an Exorcist movie? That's just a good idea.
Maybe this is where Mike Flanagan got it. This like obsession with letting actors, not letting them, sort of inviting them, forcing them to talk for like 11 minute stretches. In all of his like miniseries for Netflix.
Once you see it done well, you're sort of like, I can see how, yeah, someone would copy that and think, might as well give it a whirl.
Yeah. Have you seen those? Like Haunting of Hill House?
No.
And then the new one?
I have no interest in his output whatsoever. I don't want to watch a scary TV show.
Whoa, why?
No.
Okay, okay.
Can't be bothered.
We'll see. We'll check back in next year and see if there's been any movement in the brave trajectory.
Okay. All right.
How's your post-festival come down been? I know you saw, as usual, like a million films. So you must have been exhausted by that.
I was so tired. I was so ready to never see a movie ever again. But I think the nature of the festival this year was that there was this kind of embarrassment of riches. So I came out of it being like, I missed all this stuff that I wanted to see. I had like a week of sleep after the festival was over and it was like, well, now I have to figure out when to see Priscilla because I missed it at the festival. And I got to figure out when to see all this other stuff because I missed it at the festival. So it sort of never ends. I really felt like totally bombarded in a way that was at first kind of frustrating. And then I just kind of fell into the swing of it. I don't know. How did you feel? You were kind of coming back and forth.
I know. It's kind of the same thing. I thought that the schedule was like, because I was training in and out, like more diffuse this year than I think it seemed last year. And then I was traveling in Nashville, like the weekend that May, December and Poor Things and like Hitman were all programmed. And that was really hard because I think May, December was like my most wished for screening. And now I have to wait for like, I don't know, December ? To see it.
Two more weeks?
December on Netflix, which is not a fate I want to end up with, but yeah.
Mid-November at Lincoln Center, if you can come on down.
Oh my God. I absolutely can't. But I'll try. There was like one day when I was supposed to come on like the 6 a.m. train and then come out at the 5 p.m. train, end up not doing that and missing Maestro, which I feel poorly about missing Maestro, feel okay ultimately, like an adult, I guess, about prioritizing like rest. And I'm really, really proud, not proud exactly, but like just pleased that I didn't get sick over the course of the screenings, because the density, both in terms of transit and like screening space, was crazy.
Yeah. I got sick. I get sick every year. So
did you?
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. It's okay. I'm fine.
Our strongest soldiers.
I didn't get COVID. I had a very mild cold. But every year I go down.
Terrible. Yeah. Undeserved.
Well, another bad festival.
Fran, let's talk about the films, and maybe we'll start with one that I know that we've both seen, because even though we didn't see it together, you have since panned it in Fran Mag.
Yeah.
The film is All of Us Strangers, directed by Andrew Haig. Fran, what didn't you like about this?
All of it, basically.
It's like the question I can't ask my students, so I'll just ask you.
I mostly like Andrew Haig's prior work. I really like Weekend. I love 45 Years, one of my sort of ultimate feel-bad theatrical experiences. It's a little more muted on Lean on Pete, but that had the misfortune of coming out the same month, at least back in Chicago, as Chloe Zhao's The Rider. And I was just like, I don't need to see more sad guys with horses that something bad might happen to. And I was quite excited for his new movie, which is sort of pitched as this, you know, weepy-ish gay romance starring Andrew Scott, a guy I like, and Paul Mescal, a guy I like. And I was just so profoundly bored and cynical. I felt that the film as an exercise was a deeply cynical one, and I continued to turn on it throughout the course of watching it. It felt like a therapy session. I don't know.
Yeah, I was so happy to read your discussion of it in Fran Mag, because I had a really similar reaction. And the whole time I was thinking, my dad is dead and this doesn't do anything for me. It's bloodless and obvious in terms of approaching like the trauma of loss. And there are definitely moments that were sort of slightly more interesting, I guess. And I know you and I are like differ in terms of ultimately reception of After Sun, but that movie was so in the front of my mind watching this one, not least because of Mescal's, like, you know, starring in both. But it was so frustrating that to have all these great ingredients, right? Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal, this like gay high rise, spooky romance situation with some promise of melodrama. But then I just feel like all the stuff around time and kind of like a fantastic treatment of time was so unsatisfying.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie where I felt like it's all text. It's no subtext. These are just characters back and forth going, and how are you feeling now? And is that sad? As well as just, I think, a profound lack of image making in the way it looks. I was also compelled by this high rise where seemingly just two sad gay guys live. I would say the high rise in the movie High Rise is maybe the most compelling thing about it, creating this like weird, you know, post-postmodern development and how weird these buildings are to live in. And the film felt so uninterested in setting as a means of delivering story beyond these are some guys who sometimes see each other in the elevator. I was very bored and I got very angry throughout. And then I would get angrier the more I felt that the audience was really feeling it, because I was like, I don't feel what this thing is. Yeah.
100%. In my screening too, there were people crying all around me, which is fine. And I don't in any way meaning to like critique the emotional journey of like fellow audience members. But I think it like brought up a sensation of cynicism and indifference and kind of like resentment in me that was uncomfortable also. Like it was uncomfortable to experience, because then I felt like a dick, basically. And you're so right about the setting, which is so weird, because in another way, it's a movie that seems purposelessly really interested in setting insofar as the interior design of the apartment is so clearly intentional. But whatever the intention is, I have no idea. Outside of like, it looks a little bit like an Almodovar film, but more muted or a cooler palette or something. But I couldn't understand what that emphatic style was supposed to be doing in a film that, as you observe, is not so stylized.
Yeah. Doubling back to After Sun has really risen in my estimation, having seen this. I balked at After Sun, I think, because I felt it was in some ways manipulative. And I think, you know, all movies are kind of manipulative. But what was moving to me about After Sun when I saw it was its refusal to give in to closure.
Mm-hmm.
All of Us Strangers is just a movie about like the indulgence of closure.
Mm-hmm.
It felt to me like really unrewarding in that sense, because it's like baiting you into being like, wouldn't it be nice if you could have these kinds of conversations? And it's like, yeah, I guess, but there's no further question beyond that. And not really interested in anyone in that movie who doesn't want to engage with that premise either. I don't know.
Yeah. In terms of these kinds of conversations, without giving too much about the film away, I was also really thinking about, oh my God, what is it called? It's not Souvenir Part 3. It's The Eternal Daughter, and how there is this kind of staging of an impossible conversation in that film. And in that film, I found it extremely moving. This implied wish to converse with someone who is not present and have them say conciliatory or merciful things to you that you couldn't have heard when they were still with us or something. That, I don't know, for some reason really worked for me and on me in a way that here it feels content-wise really similar, but the execution, I don't know, just didn't do it.
Yeah. I think when I talk to people about criticism of, you know, movies or books or whatever, I'm always like, the main thing I want to see or engage with is like, I really want the element of like surprise at some point. And I don't think the surprise has to be shocking or like bombastic, but I do think I need to be like caught off guard of what I've seen in stories before. And I think that moment in Eternal Daughter and like Souvenir and some other movies in here, like, really caught me off guard in a way that's thrilling. And when I cry at movies, it's often because I've been caught off guard by something. And this felt so like it was poking me like with a pen in the shoulder, being like, pretty sad, right?
Right.
Would be sad to think about. You might want to cry thinking about it, maybe. And it starts at that. It doesn't even really sort of build to it. It just sort of begins there. And I got very frustrated.
I'm glad that you said that thing about After Sun rising in your estimation in the time that's elapsed since, because that's something I wanted to ask you. I know you've been going to the festival and other festivals for a really long time, and I'm curious how often there are films that really shift in terms of how you feel about them, what you think about them in the months or even years after first encountering them.
That's such a good question. I feel like there's one big film every year where when I think back on it, I'm just like, I really underrated that or I didn't get it this first time around. For a movie I really loved, like Cold War, I definitely had that reaction to. Cold War left me so cold, dare I say, when I saw it at New York Film Festival and didn't really know what to make of it. What else? Undine, a movie. I mean, I always kind of liked Undine, but that was also had the disadvantage of being the pandemic year. So those were all movies I saw on my laptop. And when I finally got to see Undine on a big screen, I was like, well, this is amazing.
Yeah.
I think of last year, Decision to Leave, which we saw together. Yeah. And I think we're kind of like, well, whatever, has really risen in my estimation since then. That's a movie I find myself thinking about a lot.
That's a movie I would say, like, it just, I love your framework of the most important thing is that a movie surprises you on some level or takes you aback. Bok Chan-wook's filmmaking, for me, even though I totally get like the criticisms of it being sort of like overwrought or precious or something, but is always surprising. Always I'm gasping on some level, even if it's just sort of at like how he does the opening credits or like the way that he'll magnify a feeling in a scene to really push it and its narrative importance. Those strategies, I'm just like, he thinks different. He's on another level. And it always like is so memorable to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder what that'll be this year. I'm always curious to know, like, what will sit better with me. And maybe this is a good way to pivot into a movie from past festival I've been thinking a lot about is Sybil, in part because we saw Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall, which we both really love.
Yes. What a romp.
How are you telling people to go into this movie is maybe my question for you.
I think for me, I'm like, what if Broadchurch was funny is how I feel about the movie. There's everything satisfying about a procedural, which for me is like one of the most pleasurable genres is here. The uncertainty of like what quote unquote really happens. The great trial courtroom sequences. I love the narrativity of it. Like I love interrogation scenes, testimonial scenes, all that stuff so much. And I think Anatomy of a Fall is just like doing that to 11 throughout and for like a really long time in a way that really impresses me. The way it distributes information, like what we learn as viewers, seemingly experiencing things firsthand as if witnessing at the beginning and then later hearing about things secondhand as if we're sort of in the gallery of the courtroom is just like super smart. I don't know. I was just able to really relax while watching it. Like I wasn't worried about what was that, which just sounds crazy, but just as like a as a film goer, I was like, okay, it's all gonna unspool as intended and I can just like enjoy.
It is kind of relaxing, even when it is briefly stressful at times, even when it appears as though a dog might be in too much peril.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
She's able to kind of reel that back in an effective way. Yeah, it helped to see this movie as I was really in the thick of a big HBO miniseries binge. Because it does have that Sunday night on HBO kind of feel
it
to it of like, well, here's my priority viewing and like, ooh, we're all going to pick different sides and like different people. I put down The Staircase. I thought The Staircase was too grim and too unfun.
Me too.
And this felt to me like, okay, I can finally have my own staircase. I can finally have Swiss Staircase.
Yeah, totally. Swiss Staircase that's like safe to watch because I too found The Staircase just like way too harrowing. It was just disastrous for me, basically, after like the third episode. But what is that Nicole Kidman, Hugh Grant series on HBO?
I thought about that show a lot. I never saw it. The Undoing? Is that it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's maybe more The Undoing than Broadchurch, but then retaining the mystery of Broadchurch because The Undoing. And isn't it the same thing with that Adrienne Lyne like erotic thriller, Deep Water? Both of these are narratives where what seems like is happening is exactly what's happening. And it like might tempt you into thinking that there's an alternative explanation, but it's actually like shocking how straightforward and your first guess is the right guess. Both of those are. But I mean, obviously that format is less to do with what happens here. But like the vibe, the procedural vibe of that, I think is pretty present. And the theater of it.
Mm-hmm.
Antoine Reinhart as the prosecutor. Just
An
astonishing performance.
Such a great, and I'll say it, surprising performance.
Absolutely.
Especially, you know, because Anatomy of a Fall, that's a longer movie. This is like a 2.5 hour film. The trial starts maybe like 50 minutes, an hour in. So you kind of feel as though you're getting the rhythms of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think the introduction of the trial, if nothing else, really upends the cadence of everything, which is really affecting. Because I think leading up to the trial, I felt very sort of like, well, I think I sort of know what's going on here. And then not so, both in tone and detail.
Every month on Brightwall Darkroom, we belly up with critics, artists, and contributors to speak from the heart about film, which got us thinking, what if we had a space like that every day of the week? A space where artists can go off script on love for their craft.
Introducing Gallery, a new cinema club built by today's most celebrated filmmakers. Helmed by Indian Paintbrush, the folks who brought you the Grand Budapest Hotel and the Asteroid City, Gallery combines personal film collections, thoughtful essays, and live experiences into a single destination. Built by artists as a response and alternative to binge culture, Gallery is not a streaming service. It's all human, no algorithm. A communal cinema experience that celebrates the nuances so often missing in today's industry. And Brightwall Darkroom listeners are invited to receive early access before its official public launch.
Gallery is shaped by many filmmakers that we love here at Brightwall Darkroom. including Mike Mills, Karen Kusama, Ed Lachman, Taylor Russell, Ethan Hawke, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. Members will enjoy access to these artists' hand-picked film libraries, as well as original videos, audio stories, in-depth articles, and exclusive live events. Because, like Bright Wall Dark Room, Gallery is a community that believes movies are better experienced together.
To join the club, go to www.join.gallery.com/BWDR. That's GALERIE.com/BWDR. Let me ask you this, because now I want to know what the element of surprise was in like every movie that you enjoyed at the festival.
Okay.
Yeah, buckle up.
I had a friend who used to review everything on Letterboxd by identifying the trippy scene.
Nice.
Even stuff that did not have like a trippy scene, but this is my version of that.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. So what was the jump scare in Bradley Cooper's Maestro?
I think the first time he opens his mouth, it's a jump scare. I mean, my review of this movie, I didn't record myself coming out of any of these movies, but the text I sent like a trillion times over is like, it's crazy all the sentences you hear him say with that voice. And you think you sort of know what the voice sounds like. And then he says a new crazy sentence. And you're like, that's maybe the craziest sentence of all time. I don't want to like give away too much of Maestro.
Mm-hmm.
I think not unlike Star Is Born. Like Star Is Born did not market itself as very funny, even though like, I just want to take another look at you. Like, that's played very in earnest, and it's sort of just like funny because it's nice. I think Maestro has very similar comedic sensibilities where, like, there's a lot to laugh at in that movie, very much on purpose, but I think they're sort of best left in Discovery because it's not a comedy, but I think he's quite adept at showing how and when real people are funny to each other and that they laugh about stuff like that. Yeah, I think the voice of Maestro, and I think the ways in which I'm such a huge Leonard Bernstein fan, both as like a figure in the American arts, but also just as a composer himself. I was curious to see what role just his music would play. I think a lot of the score of the film is just using Bernstein music, some of which is, you know, score for other films, like say On the Waterfront. And it's really cool to be like, well, they're using the On the Waterfront score in Maestro as sort of the score of Maestro. That's very shocking to me. I was constantly sort of every 8 minutes of Maestro, I was like, I can't believe he's doing this. And I just find him to be a very audacious, sometimes in a very silly way, but sometimes in a very beautiful way.
Well, I love the way that you write about Bradley Cooper's, you're like the Bradley Cooper auteur theorist. And I just want to read a moment from your review where you say, "The cumulative effect of Maestro is audacious and moving. For too long, we have valued filmmakers who are geniuses. It is time to return to valuing filmmakers who are well-meaning lunatics, risk takers, or romantics. Lucky for us, Cooper is all three," which is just such a like generous and specific characterization of his work and like the humor in it.
That's sort of as best as I can describe his style and his auteurist intent, is that he's definitely a crazy guy who really believes in love, and he has Marvel Cinematic Universe money to do that, to execute that vision. And there are very few people on his level of his peers who are interested in doing that. And so I'm always going to be compelled by what it is he's amassed the funds to try to pull off, whether or not it's totally successful. And I think I know far more people who do not like Maestro than I do those who like Maestro.
Oh, but
I'm really, I was very moved and satisfied by it.
I want to use the link of the music and using the music of the subject to soundtrack the film itself to talk a little bit about Priscilla, which notably has no Elvis Presley music in it and is something that lots of critics are like writing about or asking Coppola about. And I mean, the obvious answers of like money are not that interesting, but it's so weird to have the entire film create this spectral other Elvis that almost like isn't a musician. I mean, we have a couple scenes in that movie where you see a sort of like silhouetted backlit Elvis Presley played by Jacob Elordi performing, but you don't hear anything, or what you do hear is like a really great needle drop by someone else. That's just like a bog standard Coppola cool stuff playlist type of thing. It's so strange, but I think works really well for a movie that's trying to like center, obviously, Priscilla as opposed to her husband.
How successful do you feel like it is at centering her?
I think it's really successful. What Kaylee Spaney has to do is so insane. Like to play a character from, I think it's like 14 to 27. And they said that the shoot was like 30 days. It's wild. Like I think she does a really good job of giving a dynamic range. It's a little Lifetime movie, that trajectory of being sort of like wide-eyed and basically a preteen and then ending up a kind of like grown woman, mother, standing on your own 2 feet type of thing. But I think you have to have a lot of magnetism to stand next to and be like visible next to Jacob Elordi playing Elvis Presley, where the charisma is just like outrageous. And she does that, actually.
Yeah, I think of her films as being so good about people in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
I like most of her movies, but when they feel really successful, they really nail that sense of loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Watching the sort of marketing of the film be like, well, don't forget Jacob Elordi is in here and he's Elvis too. I'm sort of like, does she get lost in this? But perhaps it's more about getting lost in that than it is about standing solo.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that Coppola is like the director of like girl Stockholm syndrome throughout different points in history. And that's how this movie plays. Absolutely. It's like she's in prison and she loves it until she doesn't.
I mean, I think Maestro and Anatomy of a Fall are also about the nature of like, do you have to agree with a relationship, this terms of a relationship that you agreed to decades ago?
Yeah.
And how do those terms and people change?
Mm-hmm. I love this game. How do the movies connect?
Yeah. But like where I get sort of annoyed with Maestro is that I think Cooper thinks he's doing this very beautiful tribute in making Carey Mulligan first build, as though to say like the real main character of this movie is Felicia Montalegre. But it's like, that's not true. The movie is called Maestro. And however much it makes attempts to center her, I think it's never really as successful as that gesture of billing in a way that feels kind of phony to me, ultimately. But also very Hollywood in a way that I love. Be like, this is activism.
Did you feel the same way about A Star Is Born with Gaga?
That's a good question. No, I think that's almost more of a two-hander than this is.
Mm.
I mean, Maestro's so tough because it's like, these are real people. If you want to know what happened to them, this information has long been very readily available. But it's like, you know, Cooper is the one who's suffering health-wise in the back half of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's the opposite in Maestro. And I think to have this like elevated woman, you know, this actress, this role is being elevated to first billing, but a lot of her sort of solo time where she's really supposed to be like hitting it home is like her suffering from terminal illness. Like, I don't love that. That feels very cynical and very Oscars-y of like...
Yes.
How I felt like we were sort of watching Felicia Montalegre die for an hour of that movie. It's not that much. I truly don't think it's longer than like 12 minutes, but it really did feel like, oh, all the like super good stuff here is going to come as like a side effect of death, which is not when I think Cooper is ever doing his like best work. And I think that's true of Star Is Born too. Whereas like when that stuff gets bad, it gets too bad too quickly.
Mm-hmm. I'm completely obsessed with this framework that you're imposing on different films. And now that I'm thinking about the rest of the films on the docket, could apply to them too, which is like renegotiating the terms, the original terms of a long-term relationship. We both saw Catherine Breillat's last summer.
Yeah, we did.
Which is maybe also can go in the renegotiating relational terms bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, with in jail where she belongs. Yeah. Just kidding.
Yeah, the Brightwell Darkroom podcast does not endorse pedophilia ?
Well, yeah.
And what did you make of this film?
I think this movie is like one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. I was laughing and laughing. And I was so relieved. I went to one of the public screenings of this. So
yeah,
I had no idea sort of what the reaction was going to be. And I was very relieved that everyone was kind of laughing at it and that we were all just having a great time. I mean, I think that like, oh, I want to get her name right. Oh, I think that Leia Drucker, who plays Anne, the sort of central focus of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
This to me is like a Kristen Wiig character. It is so slapstick and silly. And every time you see her once again be sexually tempted by her teen stepson, it's like, don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, it's like, don't do it. And then I think every time she sort of falls victim to her own impulses, it mm-hmm. is funnier every time. It just, mm-hmm. it really did feel like a prank in a way that I found very delightful.
That's so funny.
Were you having fun?
I had so much fun. I think my biggest laugh is when Teo, played by Samuel Kirshner, who is the stepson in question, his like girlfriend appears on screen, whose name I think is Amanda. And she's so a caricature of like, this is what a young woman looks like. She has like all this long hair and she's wearing like a tiny nothing skirt and is just kind of like rude. And it's like, of course, that's what your sort of erotic rival is when you're in a relationship with someone who's like 16. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, 17, I think.
17.
I see.
Yeah.
She just barely gets away with it, I think, for whatever the European law is. I mean, I think the movie is funny because they're like playing to stereotype.
Yes.
A little bit. And they're embodying these tropes. Mm-hmm. And I think also that Olivier Rabourdin, who plays Pierre, her husband, mm-hmm. the way he's always just having the worst time in the world eating a pasta that she just cooked for him.
I love that moment.
Felt very much. Yeah, that felt, I mean, like the skeleton key to the whole thing of like, anytime you see this guy, he's eating pasta for dinner and he's having the worst day of his life.
Yeah.
It'd be one thing if it was just the relationship that it's funny, but all the moving parts along the side are equally funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad that Brayat is making movies again. It's like a 9-year absence after her last one. And there's a great like Kaijus interview where she talks about how all the performers were in a quote state of grace while shooting the film and that they're like really going through it. And that she was being really meticulous and rigorous and demanding, but everybody just like gave it their all. I mean, it doesn't say anything like that, and especially not in the French. But she also said that she slept in like the marital bed during production. Like that's how sort of like constantly on set apparently she was. Maybe they all were. I love that the interview makes it sound like she made this like opus or something. And I really enjoyed Last Summer, and I think it's got a lot to recommend it, but I sort of appreciate that that's the experience of shooting it. And then the product is just this sort of like good little film or something, like a funny entry in the like age gap canon of French cinema. I don't know.
Yeah, a real sort of like, what will they come up with next in France type of film. She came out to introduce it at the public screening, which was great.
Oh,
and she
cool.
said something to the effect of like, I'm so happy to show this movie in New York and not in France where they hate my work so much.
Wow.
It's crazy that a film like this that feels to me so French in its, not even like sensibilities, but its mannerisms maybe. I think even the comedy feels kind of French, hits so hard with an American audience. Though that's, I guess a New so York funny. Audience is like kind of French in its own way.
Aspirationally, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the detail that you pulled out of like the way that Pierre eats dinner. And I think there's so many of those weird little details down in terms of like what characters are wearing, the way they take up space, the way the like adopted daughters have like smeared lipstick all over their mouths for the latter like half of the film. It's just so much like weird, funny, almost like farcical stuff going on, despite this like very harrowing plot. And then also these background plot vagaries around Anne's work as like an advocate, seemingly for young female sexual crime victims. At least it's that, I think, in the Danish film that it's a remake of. Just like a strange set of effects.
My understanding about the film that it's effectively kind of remaking is that the original is almost undisputedly evil. Just bad vibes the whole time. And I think where she's really made it her own is in the archness of the rhythms and how the characters relate and talk to each other. And I hear that the endings are very different as well, but I won't give away either.
I want to see it. Is it Queen of Hearts, the Danish film?
Yeah.
I really want to see that. I think Leia Drucker is a really inspired choice for this. And I remember her a lot from the film In My Skin, which is a real Fran and Her Brave Era movie that I actually like hope you never see because it is so difficult to watch. But Marina Devan directed it and stars in it. And Leah Drucker plays her kind of like jealous best friend. She just has this great, like everything that French people do about exhaling into their own mouths to punctuate words and sentences or like make it sound like they're making fun of things or that, or just to say, I don't know, is Leah Drucker is just like the best at it.
It's an amazing performance. It really toes the line. And yeah, she plays it with just a light enough touch to kind of entrance anyone.
I don't want to focus like too negatively on things. So maybe I'll just ask you to highlight a couple films, one that I know you liked very much, Annie Baker's Janet Planet, and one that I know you did not enjoy very much, which is Bertrand Bonello's The Beast.
Janet Planet is a film I really and truly enjoyed. It's also the winner of my own personal New York Film Festival award of quiet movie where two people almost got into some kind of altercation right before it started prize. Where someone came in maybe a minute late and had their flashlight on to look for a seat. And someone said, hey, will you turn off the flashlight? And the person with the flashlight said, I need it. And then the person who initially told them to turn off the flashlight said, no, you don't.
Oh, my God.
The thing you needed to do was get here on time.
Stop it.
And then it's like going right into, you know, the like most quiet movie to ever exist. But that rocked. It's always during like a very peaceful A24 movie.
Yeah.
That this happens. I wonder what it is. I don't know. But I have been an Annie Baker fan for a couple of years now. Mm. I love reading her work. I was lucky enough to see her most recent play live, which I've never done with any of her stuff before. Mm. And I just am such a big fan of her sensibilities and her sense of humor.
Mm.
And coming of age movies can be really tricky because they can feel really cloying or prescriptive. I think sometimes the best case scenario is just like, I'm too old for what this movie is, but it's a really great coming of age story about a type of child we just don't see a lot of movies about, which is just like a really and truly introverted child named Lacey, played by Zoe Ziegler. And I think it's just an absolutely genius child performance such that like, I hope she never has to be in a movie ever again. I think she doesn't want to, you know?
So great. I know what you mean. It's so great to have like a non-pick me kid movie.
Yeah, where half of the laughs of that movie are just seeing how she's going to react to something ever so slightly.
Hmm.
I was sort of like, how will Baker's theater brain adjust to making a film? And what we get in turn is a very solid like three-act movie where it's even sort of separated into acts. But it basically tells the story of like Lacey and her mom, Janet, played by the always good Julia Nicholson. Mm-hmm. And they live in Western Massachusetts. And Lacey demands to come home from summer camp where she's having a really bad time. The tone of the movie is that it opens with her like sneaking out of her cabin to go to the payphone in the night, set in the 90s. And she basically is like, hi, it's me. If you don't come pick me up, I'm going to kill myself. Which, and then the next thing we know, like her mom's there, like the threat worked, but now she has to be home with her mom all summer. And the acts are sort of structured around a new adult person that her mom has around and over in the house. Some of these characters are engaging more directly with Lacey and some of them really want nothing to do with her. And it's just how she observes them and how it upends their sort of life together. These two women.
I can't wait to see it.
And then The Beast.
The Beast.
Made me so angry.
Please tell me about it. Please don't hold back.
No, I mean, I like some of Bonello's other films. Mm-hmm. I think he's often quite funny. This movie really wore me down. It's doing a kind of The Fountain / Cloud Atlas thing. We have a couple, basically, played by George MacKay and Léa Seydoux. Every new movie I see her in, I'm always like, well, she's done her best work yet once again. So I love her performance in this movie. But we're seeing these two characters across a huge kind of scope of time. We see them, I believe, in the early 20th century, I think like 1914-ish. Mm. We see them in 2014. Then we see them again in 2044. It's sort of sci-fi. It's sort of period piece. It's a very kind of muddled and frustrating exploration of this topic of like, if the world is so bad, what if we could opt out of it?
Mm.
I think the lens through which to view it is that in the future, these are two people who are interested in engaging in a service that will allow you to basically get rid of all your feelings. You can just vibe
okay.
what the cost of that might be. And so in the past, we see them go through some really traumatic stuff, both together and separately, to be like, is it worth being alive if something like this could happen to you?
Mm.
But it's also about class and Hollywood and male isolation. It's essentially adapting a Henry James, but he's also borrowing from some other texts as well. And that's where the movie started to lose me. The 2014 section is really where I started to turn on it. And then it just never got me back. Yeah.
I don't want to weigh in too much because I haven't seen it, but the way that you're describing it makes it sound like a Black Mirror episode.
It's a little Black Mirror-y, but I think it's much more experimental in its sort of wild oscillations of tone.
Okay.
But I think not unlike All of Us Strangers, they are constantly just all speaking in text to each other. And there are some really fun, interesting, like visual gimmicks that feel like Black Mirror, but better.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of reaches a conclusion that I would say is quite derivative of, if not probably paying homage to, another very famous conclusion in a way that also kind of frustrated me, because I was like, this movie does feel so original in so many ways that to end with this like very direct homage to something else almost feels like you yourself don't really know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Or what it all builds to. I sort of don't want to give away some of its like cultural touchstones because I think they're kind of fun on discovery, but if you're like me, you're sort of like, not this. Don't reference this. I don't care about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. But I think his work is always kind of provocative and frustrating in its own way. So I think I'm really in the minority on The Beast. And I'll be curious to know what other people think of it. I feel like you could like The Beast. And I don't mean that as a knock against your character. I just wonder.
I'm so interested.
I just think it's very brave, Vera, I will say. I'm almost not brave enough for it. But I think that's because so much of the second half of the film is about just escalating sense of dread. And I got very bored of feeling dread, which maybe some dread types will love.
I really like hearing you talk about films that I haven't seen yet, because the way that you describe them is so specific, but also like so circumspect, which I'm terrible at. I feel like I'm much more of like a spoiler heavy like film discuss. But did you see that, like, what is it? The Red Scare Girl, her horror movie about...
No, The Scary of 61st.
Yeah. You did not see that film? Because that does a thing.
No.
That sounds exactly like in form, like what you're saying this film does about citing a really famous cultural touchstone in the conclusion and it falling flat, at least it did for me, in like a profound and sort of testifying to the idiocy of the film kind of way. So I'll be interested.
Well, you know that Dasha is in The Beast.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, she's in The Beast. So they might have kind of informed each other in their own sort of way. It's a very small role, but it is
interesting.
Funny.
That is interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah, to see her pop up. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's quite good, I'll say.
Good for her.
Yeah. Yeah. But speaking of my brave era.
Yeah.
How nervous do I have to be for Ferrari?
Oh, kind of nervous, because there is violence in the film.
I'm hearing it's quite intense.
It is. You would think that like race car driving as a metaphor for filmmaking would run its course, so to speak, like, and not have that much more new to tell us. But the sort of like myopia and relentlessness of racing makes a lot of sense, I think, when applied to the process of making a film like this, or of making any film if you're Michael Mann or other people too. But then also it reproduces that experience, I think, for the viewer in a really incredible way, where I just felt completely physically stuck in one place and also hyper-focused and also just in a state of suspense, in a way that if I had been watching it at home, I would probably be tempted to fast forward through some parts out of sheer like exhaustion from being like worried about what would happen next, which is just a thing I will admit I do sometimes. But there's definitely some, like, the inclusion of some violence that is sublime and delighted me, I have to say. Like, aesthetically, I was like experiencing wonderment while watching these images happen on screen. And it was also really pleasing to hear the kind of chorus of just like anxious noises that people were making all around me, both like in anticipation of and reacting to those sort of scenes. So I would be maybe a little nervous, but also like, you've got this, Fran.
I'm gonna be brave about it. Is there a currently existing Michael Mann film that it feels like most companion to? I hear a lot of people saying it's very like late style, but that we don't really know what that is for him yet.
Yeah. I mean, I think Heat is the film that I thought of the most because Ferrari really plays like a heist film, much more so than like a biopic. And it's sort of attention to the compression and pressurization around like a really small amount of time, which has very high stakes. And the stakes are like both personal insofar as with things like money and status, but personal in terms of relationships also. That's what it really reminds me of. But I can understand why people might be trying to characterize the style as undergoing some kind of transformation, maybe toward a more classical mode of storytelling, because it is pretty classical and pleasing in that way. Like, it's very cause and effect. There's not as much kind of like weird lyrical stuff going on. I don't think it does away with ambiguity entirely, and particularly by its end. I loved everything about it except for the inclusion of Shailene Woodley, who I don't ever really understand in any movie, like, and definitely not this one.
She's taking some heat, I have seen, for that attempt at an Italian accent.
It's really weird. It's very, I studied abroad, very unspecific.
Yeah.
But then I have to remember that, like, Heat has Amy Brenneman in it, who I think at the time might have also seemed like a really random choice, but she's, like, so incredible in the movie. I don't really know. But then if it's like, okay, there's Shailene Woodley doing whatever she's doing on one hand, but then there's also Patrick Dempsey with like silver hair in a turtleneck. So it's really like it all evens out is what I would say.
Great. I'm happy to see him in the mix.
I was surprised. I didn't realize he was in the film, and I may or may not have like gasped audibly when he first appeared on screen.
Wow.
Yeah. I think he gets my award for like hottest performance in New York Film Festival 61. Yeah.
I mean, mine is definitely Josh O'Connor in La Chimera. That is such a sexy but sad performance. I don't know if Patrick Dempsey is sad in Ferrari.
No, not really. Just older.
Josh O'Connor is just so dirty and so infused with melancholy. This is just like the saddest guy who needs to bathe so bad. And then it has like the survivor thing of when they finally do bathe him, you're like, oh, it was better before, actually. Like, just go back. Just go back. He's too clean now. La Chimera might have been my favorite film I saw out of the festival. And
really?
And like many of my favorites that I see at New York Film Festival is coming out next year. Yeah, that it's now being sort of withheld from me for the next 6 months.
Well, when we do get it, what should we look out for?
What should you look out for? That's such a good question. You should look out for the music, because it is a great music movie on top of being like a heist movie and a romance and a ghost movie. It's got everything. But the music, I think, really caught me off guard.
I can't wait. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, is May, December like the happy ending version of last summer? Why do we have so many age gap movies in the festival? What's going on with May, December? And like, I'm so obsessed with Todd Haynes as a melodramatist. How did this movie sit with you? I can't wait to see it.
This movie is sitting great with me. I don't know if it's the happy ending version of last summer. I almost think last summer might have the happier ending, all considered.
Okay.
But it is a really funny, very silly movie, not unlike last summer. But I think the jokes are a little bit more directed towards the situation maybe than the people. I think it's a very humane movie also, but humane towards at least one person who's maybe the most evil person of all time. But it is just a treat and a surprise. And if we actually talking about music and homage, I think one of the craziest parts of that movie is that it takes sort of the main cue of its score from this movie from the 70s, The Go-Between, which is the kind of thing that I just so happened to watch like on Criterion a while ago, I think on the recommendation from a friend, but it just so happened that I had seen it. And the main score sort of tipping its hat to that. It's a Joseph Losey film. Yeah, it's from 71. It's very kind of atonement-y. It's one of those where it's like, well, once you see this, you'll be like, well, they ripped off everything from Atonement for that. But it's about a young boy who becomes kind of the letter courier for a forbidden upper class couple.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot of him like running across the fields delivering letters, and it's not right for them to be together, but TBD. And I think Haynes using that score really sort of tips his hand in a funny way. But May, December is just silly. I came out of it, I just kept laughing. I was like, they're all being so crazy.
That's a great Easter egg.
And it really makes you think about the evils of Hollywood and the evils of voyeurism, I suppose, whether it's through like the vehicle of fictional film or just how we look at our neighbors and friends.
Great.
And Charles Melton is so good. What a great performance.
Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore are two of my favorite, speaking of like funny voices, like funny little voice performers. What Natalie Portman ends up doing in Jackie, I think, is like, I cannot get enough of it, frankly.
I love that voice.
It is crazy. It's so great. And Julianne Moore in Safe. And I mean, other things too for both of them, but just these like, this ability to turn on some kind of like, just, I don't know, like breathy and a particular kind of feminine vocal presentation, I think is amazing. And I'm really hoping that's on display a little bit here.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but there's definitely a little voice going on here.
Okay.
I think adjusting to that movie at the start is part of being like, oh, someone's doing a voice this whole movie. Like, okay, great, awesome. And it is a voice totally kind of, you know, uninformed by the events of the film. It's just someone choosing to do a voice. Great. Is what this was asked about in our Q&A. Someone was like, what is going on with this voice going on in this movie? And Todd Haynes was just like, seemed like the right thing to do.
Great. What a great answer. Just seemed like the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, the line they sort of had on making this movie, which seems not unlike Priscilla, they made this in like 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks.
Wow.
And it really just seemed like they were having a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I wonder if there's like more films in this year's slate that are made under similar conditions because of the kind of production schedule's response to not just financing in general, but also like a kind of post, I'm doing post in scare quotes because it's not, but post-COVID kind of atmosphere for production. Because for Priscilla too, they really emphasized in the Q&A afterward that they were like playing pickleball on set and even considered raffling off a pickleball game with Jacob Elordi to secure like more financing for the film, which I was like, is this a joke or not a joke? I feel like maybe not a joke, but I love knowing about those kinds of like scenes of camaraderie in the background and thinking about how that informs or doesn't inform the chemistry on screen.
Yeah. What felt kind of essential for May, December is that they really had very minimal, if not no, rehearsal time. So they kind of just had to jump into things. But so much of that movie is about how alienated these people do feel from each other that it completely works. That you see everyone adjusting to everyone in real time is part of what makes it so funny.
I can't wait. Oh my God.
It's awesome.
It's going to be great. Let me just, yeah, I guess in a speed round format, is there anything else you want to preview for our listeners about any of the other films that you saw in the festival?
I love the new Frederick Wiseman documentary, Menu Plaisirs, Les Trois Gras. It is a long watch, but it is such a fun watch and a really engaging film sort of set behind the scenes at mainly one Michelin star restaurant in rural France. But there's there are two other restaurants as well. And I just think it's such an expansive and beautiful portrait of labor, where labor is also not dramatized. It's just people doing their job. You see a sort of classic scene of like chef berating a line cook in a way that is so even-handed and regular and just like, okay, you messed this up. You're not going to do this. Don't do this again. Instead of the like Gordon Ramsay and the bearish right. screaming and yelling. It felt like a nice kind of antidote to some of that, which while very entertaining is really bombastic and obnoxious. I loved Boss Davos's Here, which is sort of one of the quieter films in the main slate this year,
mm-hmm.
which I think alongside the Aki Kaurismäki movie Fallen Leaves, they're both these sort of kind of alternative rom-coms in that they are not that calm-ish, but they are quite romantic and in spirit and in tone
mm-hmm.
and feature two very root-forable couples, if you will. And yeah, they're both very, I think, beautiful and have their own idiosyncrasies that make them really exciting to watch. I'd never seen an Aki Kaurismäki film before, but I understand they all kind of share a similar rhythm. And one of the best feelings coming out of any film festival is being like, oh, I have to go watch a mm-hmm. bunch of his back catalog now because mm-hmm. I've seen something that feels really cool and new to me.
That's such a good point that sometimes the festival can seem like it's about exposing you to like the newest thing or like what is next, or like in the case of Ferrari, like, or even with the Catherine Breillat, this kind of like, what is this auteur doing right now? But that retrospective effect, I think, is totally useful too, where you see something and then you're like, oh, now I need to go back, rather than being like excited mm-hmm. for what comes next. There's a kind of like, I don't know, like defiance of unidirectional time. It's like the career goes in both directions and you can enjoy both.
Yeah, that's so well put.
Oh, thanks, Fran. I don't want to like make you like think live too much, but what I really want to just like ask you, because I love when you were like, this is Fran's personal award for like a near altercation at the beginning of a quiet film, is what would be your, if that was like a Cannes award, you know, like the golden camera, like what would your,
what would the award be called?
Yeah.
That's such a good, oh man, I'm like not coming up with like a very appropriate answer, I feel.
We'll put something in the show notes.
I was going to say like the golden gag order, because it all comes down to noise. It all comes down to like noise and disturbance of someone who feels as though they're being disturbed more than anyone else around them. Yeah.
And then compounds the disturbance, but in this way where they seem like they're immune to it.
Completely. Every single time this has happened, the person who is scolding comes off way worse,
mm-hmm.
which really makes you think about how to behave in public.
Yeah, just be quiet, everybody at the film festival.
Just be quiet and someone will adjust.
Yeah.
That guy would have found his seat, you know?
Just take it easy.
I feel very sympathetic to the guy who came late because I came late to the Wiseman. So, you know, what are you going to do?
We should all be a little more compassionate.
Yeah. We want to talk about Zone of Interest.
Oh, yeah. Can we wrap up with like a tight five on Zone of Interest?
Yeah, tight five on Zone of Interest.
Zone of Interest is maybe like the last film that we can talk about, and also the last film that we both saw together at the festival, Jonathan Glazer's film. Fran, I know from the ending of your terrific dispatch from the film festival for Brightwall how you feel about the film. And I really, really share those feelings. But do you want to say a couple things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not unlike Bonello, I consider myself a fan of Glazer's work. And I was really sort of compelled by this new one, which is this like extremely loose adaptation of a Martin Amis novel
mm-hmm.
about a German family that effectively shares one of its garden walls alongside Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And the movie is very much about the mundanity of their routine life that they are benefiting off both, you know, economically and socially and politically from horrors happening from, you know, where they swim in their pool or go down their terrible looking water slide, I have to say. I watching that movie, I was like, their water slide does not even look fun. But I think that's also like part of it is like they couldn't even bring themselves to make that fun of a water slide. It's proven quite polarizing. Mm-hmm. It's a really intense film. And mm-hmm. Glazer, being Jewish himself, really did not want to actively show violence happening to Jews in that movie or to those in the camps, and I think more or less gets away with that as a kind of framing device, but that does not make the movie any easier to sit through.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a really difficult sit. Mm-hmm. I felt really frustrated by it, in part because for a movie about banality of evil, it's like, yeah, a lot of this movie I think is quite boring on purpose to show how unrewarding and slow this kind of life is. It's shot all kind of from a distance and the colors are very washed out. This is not an enviable existence by any stretch of the imagination. But I felt most excited by it, if you can say like excited, the way I do with all the other Glazer movies, which is when it kind of ruptures its own system or breaks from form. That's sort of when I felt the most in it. But I also feel like those parts of that movie sit the worst with me over time because I'm almost like, I don't even know what this was bringing to it other than a break in. I don't know. How's it sitting with you? I feel almost no different than when I walked out of the theater a month ago where I'm like, I don't really know what to do with this.
Yeah, I just didn't like it. And I love Jonathan Glazer. And the weirder parts of his other films, I do find really fascinating and would think of as kind of like the hallmark of his style is this expansive approach to what can constitute storytelling and how to like underscore transitions or moments. And there are definitely some like big formal moments, just as you put it, to like break up the monotony of Zone of Interest. I think it's really hard for me to think about this film outside of the critical response to it and the kind of like, I think a little bit knee-jerk, ascribing a lot of like importance to the film, having a kind of like inflated sense of respect for the film and just seeing it as like critical or really courageous or just there's a lot of exalting of it that I don't understand how people get from sort of like the film itself to those reactions outside of the premise of the film, which I think is really straightforward and doesn't get more complex as the film goes on at all. And so that's like,
yeah,
I don't know. It just doesn't feel like enough, I think, in terms of insight to merit the sort of reactions that it's been garnering. And because it's Glazer, I just felt so sort of let down, where if it was a different filmmaker, if it was a filmmaker I've never heard of and it was someone's like debut film, I might actually be a lot more sort of interested in it. But thinking about it in terms of Glazer's other work, yeah, I don't know. This was not it for me. It felt punishing.
Yeah.
And I think some people would say that's the point, but I don't think I need to experience something to feel punishing for the duration of like the runtime in order to understand everything that's like evil about what the film is about. You know what I mean? It's not like a lesson that I felt was necessary or particularly like insightful.
Yeah, I really agree. And I sometimes think there's like a conflated sense of worth just when things are difficult to sit through. Mm-hmm. And I think what feels maybe kind of annoying to me about the critical response, which I like tried not to let into my head too much going into it, which is that like, I think what Glazer is doing is really trying to like reframe and recontextualize the Holocaust movie, which is something that has been really played out and is really, I think, sort of continuously offensive the longer we keep seeing this atrocity played out for entertainment. But I don't sense that the critical language around Zone of Interest is any different than it is around a Holocaust movie from like 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Like, we don't really have an elevated sense of language to talk about this. And it ultimately, I think, feels as though it's not really doing anything that different from something that might be slightly more exploitive in what you actually see. Maybe it's not the seeing that's sort of the issue around this event as entertainment or non-entertainment. I don't know, but it sits with me. So I'm also like, I do keep thinking about it. It's not existing in my brain, but it sort of baffles and angers me also.
I think that is such a good point that it might be like overestimating the importance of the visual as like the main sort of aspect of what is exploitative about depicting or like dramatizing the events of the Holocaust in this way. And that even though it may not be like working in that arena, it doesn't mean it's not perpetuating a lot of the stuff that it seems to be interested in kind of sidestepping or posing an alternative to. I think that's such a good point.
Happy to make it.
Great. Points were made.
That's so true.
Fran, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm always happy to be back on the podcast.
It's great to have you on the pod anytime, but especially nice to have a postmortem of the film festival with you, because you're so the patron saint of the New York Film Festival in my mind from a critical standpoint.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Where can we find you online?
I am on x.com as Fran Hoffner. I am on Letterboxd as Fran Hoffner. I'm at franmagazine.substack.com. And of course, I'm at Brightwall Dark Room all the time.
Perfect. You can find the magazine online at brightwalldarkroom.com. We are still on Twitter at BWDR and at the BWDR podcast. This episode is sponsored by Gallery, a new kind of film club. Listeners can sign up for access at join.gallery.com/BWDR, and you can use the code JOINGALLERY for 1 month free. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. Chad, we miss you. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands. Bye. Which is Andrew Hayes, right? Like make hay?
I think.
Or is that not how you say it?
I think Haig.
Haig.
But I'm really burying, I'm burying that G in the back of my mouth just in case.
Okay.